From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, if you like fish and fishing like I do, then you'll really enjoy our first guest. He's Brian Fagan, and he just released his latest book titled Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization.
The book chronicles how fishing grew from an important source of community sustenance to a globally based commerce and industry that helped cities grow and empires expand to an unsustainable rate of extraction that emptied oceans all by the 1700s.
That's right. All that before the internal combustion engine and refrigeration. Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization, and author Brian Fagan in the first half of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, no, that wasn't the UPS truck bouncing over a speed bump on its way to deliver your neighbor's latest round of online shopping.
It wasn't?
No, confirmed. We've confirmed.
I'm sorry, no, it was an earthquake. It happened last Monday morning, and we'll speak to a seismologist with the University of Utah to learn the details on this event, where and why it occurred, and whether or not this is something we might be experiencing more of in the future.
All that and some news from a recent survey that shows who truly supports Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Hint, it's women. We're always on the right side,
that's
Chris.
A big hint. You're right. Once again, you are right. And some important news and reminders with respect to the hazardous waste collection event coming up this Saturday morning at the Canyons parking lot, what you can and cannot bring. And there are some slight changes to the drop-off process. We'll give you the details later on in the show.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page at KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And, of course, because this is live radio and we we have some challenges sometimes arranging our interviews and stuff, we have to be fast on our feet. And we're switching our interviews that we just read about 30 seconds ago. And we're actually going to speak with Jamie Farrell first. He's with the University of Utah Seismograph Stations and Department of Geology and Geophysics, like I say, at the University of Utah. And he's here to talk about last week's earthquake that we experienced here in the Park City area. Jamie, are you on?
I am here. Good morning.
Jamie, thanks so much for first joining us and second, moving up your interview and being ready. We appreciate that. But let's just start with some of the basics. By now, we're kind of somewhat familiar with what happened, but give us a quick summary of what this event was and where it happened, how deep, et cetera.
Sure. So on Monday, September 18th, we had a magnitude 3.3 earthquake. This was located about 14. The depth was about 14 kilometers or 8 miles beneath the surface of the earth, and it was located about 11 kilometers or 7 miles west northwest of Park City, or about 3 miles south of Summit Park, just east of Salt Lake City.
Okay, so is 8 miles? Is that considered a deep or shallow event?
It's not terribly deep, no. But you know, for this area, it's pretty average. You know, in different tectonic regions of the Earth, sometimes you can get earthquakes that are really deep. But here, we tend to have a bit shallower earthquakes.
Okay. So earthquakes aren't something that we talk about much in the Summit County Park City area. Was this earthquake kind of a surprise, or when you saw this, did you think, oh yeah, that makes sense? You know, was this unusual or kind of par for the course?
Yeah, not unusual at all. We live in a seismically active area. We live in an area of the United States called the Intermountain Seismic Belt, and this is a north-south band of seismicity. That starts in northern Arizona or southern Utah, travels up the Wasatch Front, up into southeast Idaho, Jackson Hole area, to Yellowstone, and then more diffusely up into Montana. And, it's a very common place to have earthquakes. In fact, we have, one of the largest normal faults in the world here, the Wasatch Fault. And this earthquake occurred just east of the Wasatch Fault, up in the mountain block, where we see a lot of seismicity. So it's not unusual. In fact, there's been four other earthquakes of magnitude 3 or larger within 25 kilometers or 16 miles of this earthquake in the last 50-plus years. The largest one that we've seen before this one was a magnitude 3.6, and that happened in 1999. So not unusual.
Okay. So this one, is located on a fault, a known fault area?
Not necessarily a known fault. There are a lot of, fractures in the shallow crust that don't manifest themselves on the surface, and a lot of these little earthquakes happen on these small fractures that we don't necessarily know are there.
Okay.
So you mentioned that the Wasatch Fault is one of the largest faults out there. Tell us about that fault and where it lies.
So the Wasatch Fault is basically a range-bounding fault along the Wasatch Mountain. So, if you're in the valleys here, the Salt Lake Valley or Utah Valley, if you look to your east, the fault typically is right at the base of the mountain front there. And it runs from central Utah up into southern Idaho. And like I said, it's one of the largest normal faults in the world. When I say a normal fault, it means it's a type of fault that accommodates extension. So the crust here is extending, and it's being stretched apart. And when we have earthquakes here, they happen on these normal faults. And what happens is the valleys tend to drop down, and the mountains tend to rise up. And that's how we get these spectacular mountains we have here in Utah. And these large earthquakes occur over and over and over on these large faults. Here it happens to be the Wasatch Fault.
All right, and I forgot my question. First time ever. No,
you're never left without words.
Oh, here it is. I felt it. It wasn't much. Obviously, it was more, more of like somebody nudged my chair. So, what is it that I'm actually feeling? Is that actually a wave passing beneath me?
Correct. So when an earthquake happens, it sends out seismic waves in all directions. And when these waves hit the surface and travel along the surface of the earth, you feel them, if they're strong enough. Now, right now there's been 662 felt reports for this earthquake. So 662 people have logged on to the USGS Did You Feel It system and reported that they felt this earthquake. Now, there might have been a lot more people who felt it that either didn't know about the Did You Feel It reporting system, or they felt it but didn't realize it was an earthquake. Because, like you said, it can be you can mix that up and say, okay, maybe it's just a truck drove by or whatever, and not realize it, especially with these small earthquakes.
Well, I somehow missed it entirely, despite the fact that everyone else in my office felt it.
Well, I think it's interesting because I was working in a wooden structure. You work in a fortified concrete bunker. That's your office, right? So, I mean, Jamie, that has an influence on what you will or will not feel, correct?
Correct. You bring up a good point, too, and it really depends on what you're doing and where you're at. For example, if you're in a tall building, typically people in the upper floors of that building will feel the earthquake more than people on the ground, because those buildings tend to amplify the shaking as they respond to the ground moving. And also, if you're standing still, or if you're up and moving around, if you're still, you might feel it. If you're moving around, it's so subtle that you'll probably miss it. So it really depends on what's going on around you, what you're doing, what type of building you're in, and also where you're at. So a lot of times, you know, the shaking doesn't spread out uniformly in all different directions. It really depends on the geology that these seismic waves are traveling through. So sometimes, just depending on, you know, what type of ground you're standing on, you may or may not feel it.
So tell us what this, you know, 3.3 means, and where those measurements come from. 3.3 is obviously, you know, pretty small. I mean, big enough to feel, but small enough that it didn't do any damage.
Correct. So the magnitude scale was developed a long time ago. This magnitude scale was developed in California. It's been applied for to many different places. But basically what we do is we have a whole number of seismograph stations running throughout Utah, seismometers that are recording the shaking as these seismic waves pass by it. And we use a couple different types of measurements to estimate the magnitude of the earthquake. So we can say how long the shaking lasts to estimate the magnitude of the earthquake, or we can take the maximum amplitude of that shaking and measure and try to get an idea of how big this earthquake is. And the magnitude scale is a logarithmic scale, so can be a little bit deceiving. So like a magnitude 4.3 is 10 times larger than magnitude 3.3, so it's much bigger, even though it looks like it may not be that big. So earthquakes get bigger and bigger very, very fast as they move up the magnitude scale.
And then going the other way, is it possible to feel ones and twos, or are they too subtle to sense?
Typically, ones are too subtle and you don't feel them. Twos, depending on how shallow it is and how close you are to the earthquake, you may or may not be able to feel it. But typically, you need to, you know, get up into those threes to feel it kind of in a general way throughout the area.
Okay. We're speaking with Jamie Farrell. He's with... he's a seismologist, would you say, Jamie?
Correct.
Okay, with the University of Utah Seismograph Stations Department of Geology and Geophysics. And we're here talking about, among other things, the earthquake that most of us in town felt one way or another last week. And it's the first one that's been here since, the first one I've felt since in the 11 years that I've lived here. Some others have said, oh, I felt some, maybe you felt something, you know, between that time. But like you say, Jamie, it varies tremendously on where you are and what structure you're in or so. I want to ask this. I was on your website or on a website that actually tracks and documents all the seismic activity. It's a really interesting website, just a map that shows the most recent events, showing quite a few ones and twos in the northern Utah area, but the whole state is susceptible to seismic activity?
Correct. So, yeah, you were on our website, so the University of Utah Seismograph Station. If you guys want to look at it, it's quake.utah.edu. And like you said, there's a big map there showing the most recent activity of both here in Utah and in the Intermountain Seismic Belt. And you can click on those earthquakes and get information, you know, magnitude, when they happen, how deep they are. And you can also go on there and look at a map of all the seismic stations that we have. And you can click on certain stations, and you can actually look at the seismic recordings for those stations in real time. So you can see these earthquakes as they're happening. And, so a lot of people like to do that. It's very educational for kids in school. But but like you said, yeah, the whole state of Utah is potentially seismically active, and we record on average a little over 1,500 earthquakes a year in the Utah region. So, yeah, it's a very seismically active area.
This is really cool. I'm looking at the website right now. I just pulled it up. And another interesting feature here is the recent post showing kind of all of these recent earthquakes that have happened, which is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. So how many of these stations do you have throughout the Utah area, and how do you decide where to place them?
So it's a good question. So we like to put them. It depends on what they're focusing on. So typically, we want to put our seismic stations on bedrock. So something that's very coupled to the ground. And those tend to be, you know, up on the mountain fronts or up in the mountains or whatever. But we also need to fill in gaps, and we put them in the valleys. And there's different types of seismic stations that we put in. So there's certain ones that measure the velocity of the ground as it shakes. And those are your typical seismometers. But we also have instruments that we call accelerometers that are measuring the acceleration of the ground. And we have a lot of those, and those typically go in the urban areas, and those are measuring the acceleration of the ground surface, and those are mainly used to get an idea of the ground shaking during big events. So we have a lot of those instruments in Salt Lake City, along the Wasatch Front, down in the St. George area. But we have hundreds of stations throughout the state, and we bring in, you know, 600 or 700 individual seismic channels, and they all come in real time. And they're analyzed in real time, and we have a staff of seismologists and analysts that are constantly locating earthquakes and putting out information as we feel necessary.
So a listener texted me, wants to know, is this a part of a ongoing trend or perhaps the start of some activity that we may see more of? Is there any way to tease that out?
The Park City event, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say this is just normal activity.
Okay.
Along the Wasatch Front. Now, we do have a sequence of earthquakes going on just north of Utah, up near Soda Springs, Idaho. There's a lot of earthquakes happening in that area. We had a magnitude 5.3 event up there that was also felt in northern Utah. Then we have a whole series of aftershocks going on. There's been thousands of earthquakes happening in the last few weeks. Up in near Soda Springs. So these are these type of events that you can get where you have a big earthquake, a relatively large earthquake, and then you have these series of smaller aftershocks that follow it.
And are the aftershocks just like further settling after this major earthquake? What causes an aftershock?
Yeah, so what happens is when you have a big earthquake or a relatively large earthquake, you basically, you know, fracture the ground underneath, and that completely changes the stress regime of what's, you know, normal in that area. And these aftershocks are just kind of the Earth kind of getting back to some equilibrium as it's going on, and releasing the stress that was built up, and the changing stress maybe triggered some of these little earthquakes along the fault. So it's very common in large events, and there's a typical pattern that these things go for, and they die off with time, and they get smaller and fewer with time.
Here's another question I got is related to Yellowstone. We know there's seismic activity in the Yellowstone area. What's the latest going on in the Yellowstone area?
So Yellowstone, we just seem to be, we've had a pretty large earthquake swarm that was happening in Yellowstone. It started on June 12th of this year, and it seems to be dying down now, but we've located over 2,400 earthquakes in that area since June 12th.
Wow.
Largest one was magnitude 4.4. Most of them were small and not felt by anybody, and that's pretty typical for volcanic areas, which Yellowstone is. And we at the University of Utah Seismograph Stations also operate the seismic network in Yellowstone as well. So if you go on our website, you can see information on Yellowstone as well as Utah.
All right. A few more questions?
Yeah, so you mentioned that there was a 5.3 that was felt also in northern Utah. So at what point do you start to worry about damage to homes or structures or, you know, I don't know, even infrastructure like pipes and things like that? Typically around what magnitude?
Well, you could have damage with magnitude 5.3. I don't think there was any reported damage with that event. And again, it really it depends on where it's at in relative to where structures are and people are at. But if you had a 5.3 really close to a populated area, you could get things knocked off shelves or whatnot, or maybe some cracked chimneys or stuff like that. But like I said, I don't think there was any damage associated with the Soda Springs event, but you definitely could. Typically, you need to have at least a 6 or maybe even a 6.5 to get a fault rupture on that breaks the surface, so see a fracture on the surface, and we don't have that for the 5.3 that we've seen.
Oh, here's going back to what I experienced. Like I said I experienced just a mild shake, just like the my place creaked. But just seconds before I felt the event, I actually heard what sounded like a rumble. You know, like a UPS truck going over a speed bump. Did what I hear just coincidental, or is it possible to actually hear a seismic event?
No, it is common for people to hear The rumbling from the ground moving and shaking. That's pretty common. I don't know exactly what you heard in this event. It's possible, but it's not uncommon at all to hear an earthquake.
All right. So do I have to go to the?
So you weren't making things up.
So I have to go to a separate website. Did I hear it?
Yeah, that's. I don't know about that website.
but real quick before we forget, you do have that great website. Did you feel it? Give us that website again.
So it's a USGS website, and if you just Google "Did you feel it," or you can get to it from our website at the seismograph station. And what you do is you go on there, and it'll have this questionnaire that you fill out, and it'll ask you, you know, what you felt, what you were doing, where you were at,
what were you drinking?
And it'll associate your answers with a level of shaking. And it's really neat because you can map out, you know, what people were actually feeling on this earthquake, and it's pretty remarkable how much it matches pretty well with what we record with our seismometers as far as the amount of shaking.
Okay.
That's really interesting.
Correct.
Another cool application of citizen science.
Yes.
Yep.
So in thinking about some of the, like, I guess the consequences that come with an earthquake, as you start to get into these larger magnitudes, I've read and heard that, you know, for example, along the Wasatch Fault, there could be like liquefaction, there could be geologic changes. tell us more about that. What might happen, you know, if Salt Lake experienced a really big earthquake?
Yeah, so, there's multiple things that would happen. So liquefaction, correct. So, you know, the Salt Lake Valley is an old lake bed from Lake Bonneville, ancient Lake Bonneville, and all those lake sediments are sitting beneath us out in the valley. And when those things shake a lot, when they experience strong ground shaking, they lose cohesiveness. You know, like when you're on the beach and you put your toes on the sand and you shake your toes sink, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happens when you shake the ground excessively on these old lake beds. It loses strength, and you can have a lot of foundation sinking or tilting and stuff like that in liquefaction. That would tend to occur out towards the middle of the valley. Of course, up towards the fault, you would have a lot of high-intensity ground shaking. You would have a large fault rupture on the surface that could break utilities and block roads. So, it would be a major event if we got a large earthquake on the Wasatch Fault. In fact, there's a recent study that came out and said, based on what we've seen in the past by looking at the faults, the probability of having an earthquake of magnitude 6 or larger anywhere on the Wasatch Front region in the next 50 years is 57%.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Based on what we've seen has happened in the past. So, like I said, we are in earthquake country, and people need to keep that in the back of their minds and be prepared for these big events.
Can you give us that stat one more time? So it's 57%.
The probability of having an earthquake of at least magnitude 6 or larger anywhere in the Wasatch Front region in the next 50 years is 57%.
Okay, Wasatch Front.
And if an earthquake of that magnitude happens on the Wasatch Front, what might we feel here?
Magnitude 6, a lot of people would feel that. Magnitude 6 is not a huge earthquake, but it can cause a lot of damage, especially to older homes and buildings, which there are a lot of. So we call them unreinforced masonry buildings. So brick buildings that have not been seismically retrofitted or reinforced, they tend to, behave poorly with large ground shaking. So those are the structures that are mainly affected. That's why a lot of times when you have these earthquakes, that aren't huge. Most houses are okay, but their chimneys crumble over because bricks don't behave well in ground shaking. So we have a lot of those older construction type of buildings in the Salt Lake Valley, and it could be a major problem.
Wow. And how old's the house you live in now?
1896, Chris.
Oh boy.
Made of stone. So I'll be prepared.
Okay. Well, you have to be in your fortified bunker of an office that
day. That's right.
Hey, James, just a couple more questions if you have a few minutes.
Sure.
This is really interesting. And Mexico City, just to kind of tie that thought about liquefaction, Mexico City also sits on a lake bed. And
correct.
Apparently that complicated or amplified, let's say, their earthquake situation, right?
Exactly. So amplified is the perfect term to use. So a lot of times when these big valleys, these deep valleys with these unconsolidated sediments occur, this shaking moves up through these things, and they get trapped in these valleys, and they get amplified. And you get this really strong shaking in these valleys. And when you have these old lake bed sediments, they tend to liquefy, and that's why you get a lot of, historically you've had a lot of problems in Mexico City from these earthquakes.
All right, one last question from another listener. This is an environmental show.
This is a hot topic, Jamie. This is a lot of listener questions.
This is related to fracking, and I know there's a lot of fracking for natural gas and oil that goes on in the eastern part of the state. Have you seen any increases, or do you even test or monitor for seismic activity out in those oil and natural gas fields? And if so, have you seen any incidents or trends in seismic activity out there?
Well, out in that part of Utah, to get these induced earthquakes, they tend to be really, really small.
Yeah.
So you need to really have a dense seismic network around there to really get these really small earthquakes that have been induced by these wastewater injection techniques. So we don't typically record all those with our regional network. But again, if we needed to, we could go in and put in a dense network and probably record those. Mm. We do record a lot of mining-induced seismicity in the Price area, because all the coal mines.
Mm.
There's a lot of induced earthquakes from the coal mining industry out in that area. But like I said, when you start getting into these induced earthquakes from extraction techniques, they tend to be really small, and you really need to have these dense networks to really record all the events that are being triggered.
All right, we got to wrap things up. Jamie Farrell, again, he is a seismologist with the University of Utah Seismograph Station's Department of Geology and Geophysics. And once again, Jamie, where's the go-to website for people to learn more about?
So you can go to the University of Utah Seismograph Station's website. It's at quake.utah.edu.
Perfect.
Great website.
Well, thanks so much, Jamie, for taking the time and coming on early, unexpectedly. We appreciate that very much. And
no problem.
Answering all the questions we got posted. It was a really interesting topic. And we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we'll hopefully have online with us Brian Fagan, the author of Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second half of the show today is Brian Fagan, the author of Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. This book is actually being released today. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a big day.
It is a big
day. Congratulations. You must be busy.
For me?
You must be very busy. So,
I am indeed very busy. You are the first interview, and it's really a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, well, we're honored to have you join us, too, about this really fascinating book. And I have to admit that I thought there are already books about that try to chronicle the history of fishing. But this sounds like one of the first attempts to really dig into the history. I mean, going back hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years.
It's absolutely fascinating. When the idea of this book came up, I went into looking at all the various sources, and I couldn't find anything. There was one book, but it's very technical and very modern. And that's a German book, actually. But there's absolutely, that I could find absolutely nothing. So this was a unique, unusual opportunity.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, getting into the content of the book here. How did fishing kind of come to be? You know, what populations started fishing?
It's really a mirror of human opportunism. We are Homo sapiens. We are opportunists. We grab opportunities. We plan. We observe. And the two most important qualities of a fisherman are to grab opportunities and to know your prey and to observe them. And this quality goes back as far as humanity does. And the earliest record of people catching fish, or at least consuming fish, is in East Africa over a million years ago.
Wow.
And the fish they caught were catfish, which get marooned in ponds when, in the dry season, lakes and rivers lose their water levels, and the fish get marooned. And literally, you could go along, and you still can, and go to a pool and feel a catfish with your feet and lift it out of the pond. I've done that myself. And the earliest fishing in the world was literally nothing more than taking fish out of a pond.
Right.
And at certain times of the year, and you had to know when they were most likely to be there, so which is a form of opportunism.
But what I found interesting is that as, you know, technology, if you want to call it that, or as rudimentary as it was, developed, the techniques used to catch fish, whether it was in, like you say, Africa or Asia or North America or Europe, they all develop similar techniques, disparate of each other, you know, whether it's spearing or rudimentary netting and then hook and line. The technologies seemed, or the methods seemed, to sprout up in areas that had no connection with each other.
The reason for that, as far as, excuse me, I can tell, is that they adopted hunting methods on land to fish under the water. I mean, spearing a fish is the same as spearing an animal.
Right.
Nets were used to catch rabbits for thousands of years and other small animals, and so on and so forth. And the same applies to preserving fish, because you can dry them, and everybody knows you dry meat and keep it. So the techniques kind of spilled from the land into the water. And what is astounding, as you point out, is that the same methods were used nearly everywhere. And what is even more interesting, they really didn't change for tens of thousands of years. You actually get people on the cod banks in the North Atlantic in the 19th century basically using the same methods used by medieval fishermen. The change is very slow until recent times.
So what kinds of other technologies did fishing spur? I think this impacted the development of, like, boats and heading out into the ocean. Is that right?
That's a complicated one. The watercraft are really a kind of a problem on their own. They are, at their most primitive level, little more than rafts. And anybody knows that a log floats, and you can sit on a log and float across a river. And a lot of early fishing probably used very simple rafts. But I think until probably fairly recently, when people could paddle fish and paddle craft, and I'm talking maybe about 11, 12, 13,000 BC, almost all fishing was done from land. And a great deal of it was pure opportunism. For example, in France, 20,000 years ago, people were exploiting salmon runs. And for that, you just need rocks and a salmon and a spear, and you spear them, or you build simple dams and trap them and scoop them out of the water with a net. Watercraft is a different ballgame, really.
And fish farming was developed, again, thousands, if not 10,000s of years ago. We think of it as more of a modern event, but people started fish farming, aquaculture, a long, long time ago.
This is what is absolutely fascinating about the history of fishing and today, because ultimately, like hunting, fishing is all about opportunism, observation, and it's also about strategy. Hmm. And one of the big problems with fish, of course, is the variability of the catch. For example, herring in the North Sea in medieval times, they had big problems because the level of the catch varied dramatically from one year to the next for reasons that are still not really understood. And we're human, we're planning, we're logical. And the most logical strategy to preserve or to assure enough fish is to trap them in pools and farm them. And the earliest farming of fish appears to have just simply been a way of ensuring that you had enough fish. And the problem became really much more critical in, say, Egypt, when they needed enough dried fish to feed hundreds of people building, for the sake of argument, temples and the pyramids. And they let contracts, and there were fish processing plants at the pyramids, which have been excavated, and it really was the providing of fish as rations, and fish became a commodity. So today, the fish farming we're doing really is the same strategy on a much larger scale. And one of the most fascinating things to me is the extent to which fish farming, for example, in Asia, now provides a huge percentage of the fish eaten over there.
We're speaking with Brian Fagan. He is emeritus professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And his other books include Fish on Friday, The Little Ice Age, and the bestseller, The Great Warming. And we're talking about his book just released today, Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. And speaking of Fish on Friday, religion played a role in the demand for fish, the Catholic religion and its desire however you want to call it, the need for it to eat fish rather than meat, right?
It's absolutely amazing that in a way we've got a little bit fixated on Fish on Friday. It was indeed a central part of Catholic doctrine 1,000 years ago. There was the doctrine of church that you would not eat fish on holy days or during Lent. This was an atonement for Christ's suffering on the cross. Mm. But when I tell you that by 1200, there were over half the days of the year were meatless days,
wow,
which meant you either ate bread, grain, or fish. And of course, there were debates as to how you define a fish. You're really looking at a serious demand for fish.
Yeah.
And around 1100 AD, there was a massive increase in the fish trade in Europe, which revolved around cod. And this trade was originally driven by the demand for fish on Friday, which had been originally satisfied to some degree by dried and salted herring, in medieval times, was a very unattractive dish.
Yeah.
Cod, which can be salted and dried, is much more palatable. But even so, it's quite something because, for example, there were Norwegian cod cooking recipes which call on you to hammer the cod for 10 minutes, soften it. I mean, it's a huge cuisine. And what people don't realize is that the Viking journeys, or your voyages across the Atlantic, were fed very largely by dried cod from northern Norway, which was, in a way, the beef jerky of medieval times. It was light, it was easily carried, and they used it as a fundamental part of their diet when at sea. So there was much more to it than just religion. But then, of course, they discovered that cod could also feed armies and navies.
Yeah.
And the trade kind of moved more and more into that. So it really changed. But ultimately, it started with Fish on Friday.
What would you say? You spent a couple interesting chapters on cod because it seemed like the cod fishing industry was the first one that maybe stretched the limits of a one type of fish as boats, fishermen had to go farther and farther west, in this case, towards the first Iceland and then off Greenland and then Newfoundland Islands, et cetera, pursuing this fish.
The irony of all this stuff about the lack of history of fishing is that the literature on the North Atlantic cod trade is enormous. Mm. There are archaeologists who do nothing but specialize in analyzing cod bones from Iceland, which is fascinating because they began to tie down the date at which the cod were cut up in standard sizes and caught in standard sizes for drying and fishing. It's enormous. And really, the most interesting stuff, and a lot of this has been put together by a very good historian called Jeff Bolster, who has chronicled the concern and the increasing overfishing of the North Atlantic, which, of course, today reached crisis proportions. But it's an old, old phenomenon which goes back several centuries, and the kind of inexhaustible manner of the Atlantic fisheries, in fact, was a delusion. It was overfishing started then.
Well, since you bring that up, let's talk a little bit about historic efforts at regulation on fishing in order to, you know, preserve some amount of fish in the sea for the future. I was surprised to read that in the United States, efforts at regulation go as far back as 1668 in the Massachusetts Bay Colony when they banned cod fishing during the winter spawning months. But it also seems like these efforts have been largely unsuccessful. So what happened with regulation of cod, and have there been, you know, successful efforts at regulating fish?
The whole business of fish is fascinating because ultimately you're dealing with biblical teachings which say that humans are masters of the ocean and of the fish on the sea. And the litany was, and this was published frequently, that the fish of the sea were an inexhaustible resource, which of course is nonsense. And overfishing goes back to the ancient Egyptians. The Chinese were concerned about it. The Romans were concerned about it. A lot of the Mediterranean was overfished by Roman times, especially the large fish they ate in banquets. So it goes back. And it's very difficult to regulate because you get out of sight of land, nobody sees you, number one.
Right.
And number two, any form of legislation, certainly in early times, tended to be rather local. And in Massachusetts, you can do something in one area of Massachusetts. But when you've got a lot of people making a lot of money off, say, cod, oddly enough, in considerable part from supplying low-quality cod to the Caribbean for slave plantations, and a lot of money being made, it's exactly the same as oil in a way. Excuse me. It's an industry up against government regulation. And fish are particularly difficult to regulate until today when you've got much more modern ways of monitoring and so on. So basically methods before then, before modern times, were tended to be ineffective, particularly if you look at the beam trawl, which is the trawl that you put down on the bottom, and these things devastate the seabed.
Yeah.
And twice in Victorian times in Britain, they had very prestigious commissions which looked at it. And they got testimony from dozens of fishermen and experts who told them about the damage being done. And they said, no, no, just go away and the fish will recover, which, of course, is, I suppose, true, but it isn't true at all. And the only long-term solution for saving the ocean's fisheries is extremely strict regulation, regulation of seasons, regulation of exploitation of deep water, international waters, and so on. And even that's going to take years and years. So probably we're going to have to put a lot of the world's oceans into reserves to preserve the fish.
Right.
In the meantime, we have burgeoning urban populations and an inexhaustible demand for fish. And if you look at fish farming, there were all sorts of ecological problems with that. So it's a very, very complex issue which involves international cooperation, not just national efforts, which the common market to some degree has begun to do, but it's very, very difficult. And there are some now managed fisheries, thank goodness.
Yes.
Are you optimistic about the future of fish and fishing? You make the really interesting point in the book that fish are our last wild food resource. It's the last wild food that we really depend on. And to lose that link would be to lose that link would be kind of a milestone. So are you optimistic that we can solve these overfishing issues or
not? I'm going to give you a two-part answer to that. Have either of you been to Tokyo?
No, but I know where you're going.
You do.
the Tsujiki fish market?
The old one. There's now a new one, which is kind of much more modern and up-to-date, which I believe has just opened.
Yeah.
If you see the tuna auction there, with the rows of tuna, decapitated tuna, being auctioned off for huge prices, you realize the scale of the international fisheries industry, which is led to a considerable degree by Japan and Korea, among other countries. And how do you regulate that? And how much longer will you be able to harvest? And the word is harvest.
Right.
To harvest fish on that scale.
Mm.
But the answer is, I don't think that long. That's one part of the answer. I am pessimistic because I don't think we have the self-control, partly because of the pressures of the marketplace, partly because of the pressures of population. Population, to my mind, is the silent elephant in the fishing room. Growth of population, inexorable growth.
Right.
And then you've got the other side of the coin, which I'm an archaeologist. I look at human experience over vast periods of time. We are Homo sapiens. We are vicious. We are very clever. We plan ahead. We think. We negotiate. And so on. And in the long run, we always come up for solutions. They may not be, in the long term, good. But I think in the long run, some of the world's fisheries will survive thanks to clever management.
Right.
And as this catches on and people see the advantages and the economic advantages, there will be areas of the world where fishing will thrive. But it's a long process, and it requires a level of international cooperation, which the fisheries experts are well aware of, but politicians, of course, are not.
The name of the book is Fishing: How the Sea Fed Civilization. The author is Brian Fagan. It's out today. It's a release. And Brian, thanks again so much for taking the time to chat with us. It's a great book, a great read. And thank you again for joining us on This Green Earth.
Well, thank you for making my day. It was just lovely to talk about it. And thank you for the kind words.
All right.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Hey, we got to take another break. We'll be back with a news item or two, and stay with us. It's This Green Earth.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We've got a couple of minutes left, and then it'll be time to start wrapping up. But we wanted to give you a heads up on an event that's coming up here. As most Summit County residents know, there is a hazardous waste drop-off that's held in town twice a year. That's a partnership of several local organizations. And we've got another one of those coming up, right, Chris?
Right. This Saturday over at the Canyons parking lot. Starts at 9. Don't come before 9. Well,
don't
you can queue up at 9. It ends at 1.
Are people going to start lining up for this hours in advance?
People will start lining up before. That's fine, but it starts at 9 sharp and it ends at 1 sharp. Do not come at 10 after 1 with your stuff because it takes time to do all the final collection and labeling and packaging, etc. So 9 to 1 at the Canes parking lot. But here's a quick list of all the things, this is important, of what they will accept. Paints, varnishes, and solvents. And speaking of paints, they will accept, obviously, oil-based paints. And they'll take latex paints. But this year, there's a little twist. They're going to separate out latex paints first. So as you come into the parking lot, you'll go through the different stations and drop off your things. And I think the latex paint station is first. So you can bring latex paint, and they will separate that out. The reason they separate it out is because latex paint is not a hazardous waste. It can actually go in to our landfill at the county, but they're still accepting it, and they'll take it out from you. It doesn't have to go into a hazardous waste type of landfill.
And if you want, you can actually pour out your latex paint on like a flat surface and dry it.
Dry it.
And then just dispose of it that way.
All right. But you can still bring it to this event on Saturday. Of course, other things they'll accept, motor oil, antifreeze, all types of batteries, gasoline, if it's old gasoline or otherwise contaminated in some fashion, household cleaners, fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides, pool and spa chemicals. You got those, they'll take those. Acids and bases, of course, of one nature or another. Propane and white gas fuel cylinders. Of course, compact fluorescent bulbs, electronic waste, but not your giant TVs. Don't come in. Bring a TV that one person can carry. Anything bigger than that requires two big, they really don't want. You know, if you're bringing in, dropping off your 53-inch TV because you got to have that 57-inch TV, you know what? Don't do it. Bring in small TVs and stuff that you can carry. All mercury-containing items. Pharmaceuticals, of course. Talked about that and the importance of that. And mattresses, but that's a $10 fee if you drop off the mattress.
And donations are always very welcome.
That should be the last station.
The donation I want to
see
station.
Someone, you know what I want to see now? I want to see someone come in, drop off all their stuff, and then the last station leave their car to Recycle Utah and then walk home. That'll be the ultimate recycler.
The ultimate donation.
They win the ultimate donation. All right. So that's happening. We got to take one more break and wrap up. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming and American Roots is proudly sponsored in part by Donna Van Buren of the Van Buren Management Group and founder of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs since 1985. Information for Van Buren Management at 649-0652 or vanburenmgt.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Go.
It's time to thank the sponsors who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and, of course, listeners like you.
Email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. We love to hear from you.
That's right. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.
Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.
And remember, NPR News is coming up in about...
Right now.